Simeon, the bishop of Jerusalem, took all the Christians across the Jordan up to Pella for the destruction of Jerusalem. Then after it was destroyed, about 74 AD, they all came back and Christianized it. They listened to Jesus' words. Jesus says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by its enemies, get out. And so James has been killed. James had been pushed off the Temple Mount and killed in 63. He was the bishop. And his cousin Simeon took over the church as the bishop. So when they saw Rome coming and the Roman revolt broke out, they went across. They said, well, this is it. This is what Jesus told us about 30 years before. They went across the Jordan up to Pella. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming back again tonight. It's good to have you here. Sodom and Gomorrah. Here's Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea. Traditionally, we've always placed Sodom and Gomorrah down in this area, maybe even underneath that third part of the Dead Sea, the lower third of the Dead Sea. When Lot went to Sodom, they are camped up by Ai and Bethel. That's right up in this area, Ai and Bethel. The article comes out, and they're arguing that this is the location of Sodom and Gomorrah. And really, it's not a biblical. You want to use the Bible, but it's not like, you know, it's not a denominational issue on where Sodom and Gomorrah is. I would say if you say it doesn't really exist, then that's a problem. It's somewhere. But anyway, this is just interesting, an article coming out this month trying to argue for this case up here. If you can pick this up, it's a very good price. If you're interested in Biblical Archaeology Review, the price is very reasonable, I think, especially if you buy 3 years at a time. It comes out once a month, and it's fun information. I've made 3 copies of this article, and they're back on that table. So if you really want one, you can use that, or you can bring it back and share it or something like that. I just didn't make enough copies for everybody. Also, I'm going to be reading a little few quotes or facts from this book called The Stones Cry Out by Randall Price. It's one of about 30 archaeological books that I've got. And this talks about and gives us some very good information about why Sodom and Gomorrah is right here, some archaeological facts. I'm going to read through that. And so that article that I copied out has got the pages out of this book and this book kind of stapled together. And that's kind of what we're referring to. The things that you've got on your table are photographed. Copies of some of the maps in both of those books that we'll kind of be referring to. There's no right answer on that. There is a right answer, but it's not. It's something that's more about investigating. I really like this area. It's traditional. It matches many things. But when they come out in biblical archaeology, and biblical archaeology is a very solid, scholarly, it's conservative in the sense that it's not, you know, completely a minimalist. You know what a minimalist is? They're the ones who don't think any of the Bible's true or very little of it's true. Like there may not have even been a David or a Solomon, and it's all just fiction that they've just created. That's a minimalist. They pop up once in a while in there, but they're very, you know, they're not that, in a sense, negative towards the Bible. But anyway, there we've got that information. We're going to be in Revelation chapter 19 tonight. Genesis chapter 19 tonight. I've got about 7 things going on in my head, so I've got to get focused. And we're going to be reading through the story. But first of all, while we're here, the maps that you've got, that circle right there, you can see it laying around. You've got a picture of the map, and you've got some cities that are picked out there, and they always want to find 5 cities, because it talks about the 5 cities of the plain. And you know, like this would be the Jordan Valley, so there's plains coming off of this flat ground, like where Jericho's, and right behind them, the mountains start to rise, or the hill country. So this would be a plain area. They have found, and one of the papers I've handed out, has got a picture of the gate of one of the cities, one of the major cities. You can see there's a picture of the excavation work, and then they've an archaeological work, an artist's drawing of what the gate would have looked like, the shape and stuff. And remember, Lot was sitting in the gate. And one of the arguments for this site is that the things they've excavated down here, they find no gates yet. Here, right away, they find a major gate of one of the key cities. And again, it was destroyed by fire, similar to the places down here. But anyway, there's a map. You can see the circle on where that's at. What else we've got here? I'm going to flip over here and tell you some information about Sodom. Let me see if this could be... This is a unique, a different type of teaching here, so I'm going to try and get through this quickly so I don't bore you and lose my audience. You may see a map like this on there. The map that looks like this with the details, it's presenting this side of the story right here. And you've got wadis coming down. There's actually 5 wadis feeding into the Dead Sea. And a wadi is basically a valley or a ravine. And when it rains, like this time of year over in Israel, It's been raining. It's the rain season. And so there's water flowing in these ravines. We go there in June. We walk in them. They're dry. But if it would ever have a thunderstorm, and it's happened before, you're out hiking in the ravines, and all of a sudden a storm breaks out that no one was expecting, those ravines fill up with water, and they are a river, and you're walking in a river with a flood coming out, and there's been tragic situations like that take place. So when I say a wadi, it's like a river, but it's not a river like we have in Iowa that's always flowing. A wadi is dry unless it's during the rain season. So what we have here is with the Dead Sea, some of the arguments that we're going to present is there's wadis flowing in this way, draining into this part of the land. And then this part right here may have been a plain. I'm going to read a part of the article. It's going to tell you that they saw down in here trees and growth, vegetation growth that's been destroyed because it's now underwater. This would be the southern third. This is 20 feet deep. This is hundreds of feet deep up in this part. So this is almost like two different, this is like a swamp low water area. In fact, sometimes it dries up, and sometimes you can walk across right here. And we saw this summer how dry it's getting, especially because of the Jordan River. Both Jordan and Israel are pumping water out of the Jordan River for irrigation purposes. And so not as much water makes it Dead Sea. And so this is, in a sense, drying up. But anyway, these wadis each had a city on them, and the city would have a flow of fresh water much of the year. And so that's again, that map that shows you this right here is showing you the locations of, if you can see it laying around on your table somewhere. I'm going to just read through this information. I'm not going to read verse by verse or page by page, but here we go. There's two geologists made a point that they found around 2350. Again, this is right in our time period. 2350 BC, they found a size 7 earthquake came down through this area. And again, this is a fault line here. In fact, this whole portion of the land is there's shifting plates. In fact, Mount Olives is right here. There's a fault line running right through Mount Olives, and that fits in perfectly with the whole story of Zechariah, where Mount of Olives will be split in two when Jesus returns, half the mountain moving north, half the mountain moving south. And it continues all the way down into Africa, which cuts straight across here. So there was an earthquake here that would have caused devastating damage in 2350 BC. They figured that out. Also, 1924, Albright, a very familiar name. You go back in the 20s and the 30s, and you've got archaeologists. They're not the archaeologists we have today. The archaeologists that we have today, they've learned a lot from what they've done in the past, how to dig without destroying the site, how to preserve things, and they're working on different types of information and how to date. But anyway, they did it as good as they could back then. But what they found out, Albright identified this part right here as the location of Sodom and Gomorrah. And that was just kind of him kind of speculating, looking at things. They began to work on that. In 1960, another guy came by, explored the sea floor right here. And he found he found trees standing in growth position at a depth of 23 feet, providing Albright's theory that the water of the Dead Sea had risen and submerged ancient land areas and did not locate any traces of any structures. So what they found out clearly, this is now a fact, at one point this area was not underwater. There were trees standing underneath here. And so if this is the case, this would be a plain. And that a lot of times that's why people think possibly this is Sodom and Gomorrah in this area, because this is the plain that then exploded and collapsed and water filled over it. But that's, again, archaeology says that for sure. Next thing. Goes on and says, Albright also discovered structures on the land on the eastern shore. And so that's why those five cities are over here. They find there are cities over here on the east side. There's one named, you can see it on your map there, probably one of those maps. It's named Bab, E-D-H, Bab Ed-Dara, if you can see that, D-H-R-A. That is what a lot of people would think would be Sodom, because it's there and they've excavated. What they found there was a heavily fortified city. If you find Bab Ed-Dara on your map, you can find that place was heavily fortified. It had a wall where I'm looking at here. Where is it at right here? I'm trying to find it on here. It's the one furthest up here. It would be right up if this came in here like this. It's up in this area right here, and they think that would be Sodom. And again, imagine this water not being here, and this being the plain, and this is where Lot would have settled. Again, we're all kind of speculating, working with the information we can figure out. But there is a heavily fortified city there, settled. houses, numerous cemeteries, scattered artifacts that date to around 3,000 to 2,000 B.C. That's right around the time 2,200 B.C. was when it kind of came to an ended. While they're excavating there, they found this. I referred to this a little earlier. The fortification, the wall, was 23 feet thick. That's how big the wall was. And outside the town, was a cemetery with thousands of buried bodies there, outside the city. One tomb held 250 individuals, they located. Now, what had happened to this location was it was burnt extensively with fire. And, of course, when you excavate, when we went to Hazor, there's a layer of ash there because that's where Jericho or Joshua burnt Hazor. We can see where he burned it. So whenever there's a burn layer, a lot of times that's where it was destroyed. Or it was a natural fire, like the Chicago fire. There'd be a burn layer possibly from the Chicago fire or Rome when Rome burnt or something. But this was interesting right here. It says the town site was covered by a layer of ash many feet thick right up here. And all five of these cities are going to match this description. The cemetery also revealed ash deposits. Now, this is the cemetery outside of the town, which is interesting. When you destroy a city, you don't run off and burn the cemetery outside of town. It's like that speaks more of a natural disaster. The cemetery also revealed ash deposits, charred posts and roof beams and bricks that had turned red from intense heat. As they began to excavate the cemetery, I referred to this a few weeks ago, and I want to make sure I said it clearly. This does not prove that this is Sodom, especially when there's people arguing for this location. But watch this. As they began to excavate the cemetery, they found that in the final phase, just at the time the city was destroyed, there was a particular type of burial that was practiced at that time. The dead were buried in a building right on the surface. They'd build like a little hut, a little building, and they'd put the dead person in the building. Prior to that last phase, they dug deep tombs and buried them, but at this point, they buried them on the surface. But during that last phase, they buried their dead in these buildings made of mud bricks built right on the surface of the ground. Some of these structures were rectangular, some were round, but they had one thing in common. One thing, this whole cemetery, a huge cemetery outside of what could be Sodom, they had every one of those little buildings was burnt inside. It was burnt on the inside. It wasn't burnt on the outside. It wasn't like an invader coming in or the Chicago fire. It was set on fire on the inside. And then, of course, they think, well, this must have been a hygienic. And it goes on and tells you, it must have been a hygienic thing. Or maybe there's a disease, or maybe they just, one thing they did, they just put the body in there, burnt it, and now there's no disease coming from it. Or whatever. They weren't sure. But what they ended up, one of the techniques they use is they dig a channel or a tunnel as they excavate, and they can see how things came together. And as they're doing this one practice, I'm going to read it right here, they cut what they call a balk, B-A-L-K, through that building as they were digging so that they had a vertical cross-section. They could look and see the different layers of for the houses there and little buildings. And what they discovered was that the fire did not begin on the inside of the buildings in these cemeteries, all these little buildings. They didn't light them on the inside. What had happened was the fire had started on the roof of all of these buildings. So all of these little buildings where they had all the bodies, something came by and come from the top, burned on the top, and then fell in, and then burned from the inside out. So the fire started from the top, burned down, and then burned out, giving the impression it started on the inside. And so they didn't know what to do with that, except it couldn't have been, that's not how an invader burns, that's not a natural fire. They described that it had to be something coming from the top, and now we're into the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, fire and brimstone coming down. And they have the igniting, if there was, again, this huge deposits. Again, I read it right here. In the late 1920s and the 30s, they noted its abundant deposits of asphalt, petroleum, and natural gas in this area. And we still know that. Even in the story of Genesis, they were falling in what? Tar pits. They were running during the invasion when the kings of the east came and Lot was taken captive. Everybody's running and they fell into the tar pits because there's petroleum just bubbling or sitting on the surface. So here's the story. If these combustible materials had been forced from the earth by a subterranean pressure brought about by an earthquake, so here at this point, they have destruction by earthquake. They know this took place. And these gases are moved around and come up to the surface. And you have earthquakes, which cause turmoil or atmospheric disturbance. A storm develops and lightning hits it. This petroleum blows up and falls out of the sky like fire and brimstone. I mean, it's just there it is. And so that's kind of interesting right there. And they're looking at it. But, of course, it was a major disaster. And it was just, they can still find these places, these cities, but they're all burnt from the top down. And, again, God was, in a sense, destroying the place. So it's like, well, we can't find it. Right, he destroyed the place. That's why you can't find it. And then with that, if that would have took place, that could have allowed water to come down here. That would have caved in down here, and water would have flowed in and filled this up. They also found, again, this could have been a whole irrigation system using these. They did find that all these wadis were used for irrigation. They're branching water channels off of these, watering this whole area. And that's exactly what it says in Genesis. It was like the garden of God, like Egypt. And what is Egypt? Egypt is full of canals of water coming from the Nile as they water by irrigation. And that's what this whole place was. And then it was buried in this disaster. So anyway, that's some information about that. And again, just so you know, there's two stories on that, two ways of looking at it. They're still working on it. And again, this month, they're still talking about it in Biblical Archaeology Review. But they've got a different location they're looking at. So there we have it. Questions or comments? And then I'm going to start reading Genesis 19. Any questions or thoughts? Okay, here we go. Chapter 19. Remember, last week, the three visitors appeared to Abram sitting outside. He was sitting and he made a meal for him. And God comes and talked to him, told him he's going to have a son, Isaac, within a year. When he comes back in a year, he'll have a son. He's going to call him Isaac. And then the Lord began to talk to Abram about, you know, what he was going to do. And God says, or Abram says, you're not going to destroy the city if there's righteous people there. And he worked him down to, if there's 10 righteous people, he'll spare the city, which was a good point for us. Is God is willing, again, to put up with a lot of wickedness and evil and corruption as long as there's hope and somebody's doing something about it. He's always working for revival. I mean, God knows what a disaster is, but he knows how to turn a disaster around as long as there's hope and someone's doing something. But if there's, you know, if there's not anybody doing anything, well, then this is over. I'm going to do this very quickly. I want to do this so we don't forget to do it. Go to Ezekiel chapter 11. Ezekiel chapter 11. I do want to establish this fact right here, kind of on the idea that the Lord is a righteous God. He's just not, you know, smiting people. He's just not out sending bolts of lightning and just smoking people and, you know, just had a bad day and so he's going to kill this city and destroy these people here and wipe this nation out. It appears in Scripture, I detail this in the book Hope for Mary's Last Generation, it appears that God will take a people through a series of events, of warnings, of trying to lead them back. He's patient. His characteristic is he's patient. He doesn't want anyone to perish, but he is not, in a sense, you know, completely unholy. He's going to have to judge wickedness. And so there will be a point where the door is shut. The ark is closed. Sodom's burned. The end of the world has come. There is an ending to this grace and mercy. And so when you look at Sodom and Gomorrah getting destroyed like they're going to, you've got to wonder, I mean, was this just a bad day for God? Was he just like, I've had enough? And then, of course, I'm going to mention it, and here it comes. There were homosexuals in the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so, okay, well, there you go. God destroyed it because of the homosexuals. And again, homosexuality is a sin. I know it's a big issue in America and our culture right now, which says something about our culture. But it's like, you can get all bent out of shape about homosexuality, but at the same time, you've got a variety of other sins that we could put right alongside of it. And homosexuality, I don't think, is like the point of the spear that when there's homosexuals, and that's when God just really gets ticked off. Because in the Bible, when God really gets ticked off, it appears, and it's detailed in the Hope for Mary's Last Generation. I hope we got some books back there, because they don't have, they're going to come back and get it. The word is Hamas. Hamas is a word for violence, a violent generation. It's basically, it's not Hamas like the terrorist group. I wonder how they got their name, though. But it is the Hebrew word Hamas. It means violence. It's that selfish social injustice of oppressing others, using other people for your own benefit. It's social violence of just oppression. And you got to be careful because sometimes people who are talking about helping other people, they're not really interested in helping other people. That's just the going phrase that everybody's buying into. They're using it as a vehicle to oppress people eventually. So what if it lines up, if God is going to destroy Sodom like he is, then Sodom is going to have to be in what we would say, I would say, that fourth generation, that final phase where they're completely selfish. It's all about themselves, and they don't care about anybody. They oppress whoever they can to gratify themselves. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer, and then at the top, the rich fight it out for the final stand of who is going to be the last dog standing. That would be Hamas, social oppression, social violence. And now if you look in Ezekiel, Ezekiel chapter 11, I'm looking for the verse here. What did I say it was? 49, there it is. Wait a minute. Excuse me just a second. Did you guys go to 11:49? Try to. Yeah, well, you see. 16:49? Sorry. And you people have used this verse to justify homosexuality. I mean, I don't know if you've heard this verse used this way before, but they're like, see, God didn't destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because they were homosexuals. He destroyed them because they weren't friendly. And it's like, yeah, okay. Here, watch this. Verse 49. It's right out of the Bible. Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 49. Now, this was the sin of your sister Sodom. And he's talking to Judah. And he's saying, there was a sister city in your land, and she was destroyed. And now God's getting ready to destroy Judah and Jerusalem. And he's destroying them for basically the same reason. He says, she and her daughters would be those other cities on the plain, were arrogant, overfed, unconcerned. They did not help the poor and needy. They were haughty and did detestable things. Well, there's your homosexual acts. But realize, they were arrogant, overfed. They were all about themselves, and they did not help the poor and needy. If you remember in Proverbs 31 that the four phases, the fourth generation, it devours the poor and needy. Their jaws are set like knives to devour the poor and needy from the land. They eat them up like their food. Another for that I'm not saying cannibalism, but they harvest the crops for food. They harvest people for tools and whatever they can use these people for as far as equipment and tools to produce food for themselves. If it means destroying the people and getting my money or getting my food, so be it. We'll just use the poor and devour them to take care of ourselves. And this is what it was. This is a good description of that fourth generation, the Hamas generation. Arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned about the damage they're causing everybody else. They did not help the poor and needy. No, they would use them. They were haughty, and then, of course, they did detestable things. And homosexuality falls into that category, but homosexuality is not the only, it's not even mentioned in that list. You know what I'm saying right here? I'm by no means promoting homosexuality. I'm not even putting it on the table for discussion. But I want you to know, if God was ticked off about the homosexuality, you'd think he would have put that as number 7 or 8 in there, and they're homosexuals. But he does say says detestable things, which includes a variety of sexual sins and a variety of other things, including probably pagan worship and this sort of thing. So again, this is the culture we're looking at. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 19. We're talking about a fourth generation that it's a waste. It's a loss. They're completely, how do you use the word hopeless and be a Christian at the same time? How do you say there's no hope and yet have faith in God? Well, right here, I think they've in a sense hardened their hearts. They've crossed that line. They're completely gone. There is, because of free will, there's no hope for them. They're gone. And when they are gone, God's going to wipe them out. He's going to do it to the Canaanites. He does it to Jerusalem in 586 B.C. He does it to Jerusalem in 70 B.C. Brings them back because he's got a covenant with Abraham and a promise he'll bring them back. But they did go through this cycle of judgment. Okay, here we go. Chapter 19, verse 1. After Abraham had talked to the Lord, the two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city. And again, the gateway of the city would be a prominent place. They would be where they held court. He's not just sitting out there by himself, but he'd be sitting out there. That's where the leadership would be seated. So it appears that Lot, again, he's wealthy, may have risen to some place of leadership in the city. We could speculate, too, he should have been out in the fields with his herds. Some would say he's lost his herds because he's gone in the city. But maybe he's owned some property out here. He's got the cattle outside. Nonetheless, he's in the city, and he's in the gates. When he saw them, he got up to meet them. Now, again, here's a little angelology. We study about angels as we eventually go through here. But here you've got, they appear as men. They talk like men. They eat like men. They appear in the city as men. Now, we know they're angels. In fact, this is the first time they're called angels in that verse 1. Now, what does Lot see? Does Lot see two angels? I don't think so. I think he sees two men. I think these are just two men to the natural eye. He says, "My lords," he says, "please turn aside to your servant's house. You can wash your feet and spend the night and then go on your way early in the morning." Now, right there is something interesting. It helps us see. Lot, remember, in as Peter writes, he talks about how Lot's righteous soul was tormented in that city, meaning he knew it wasn't right. We just read in Ezekiel, they were, basically, some translations even use the word inhospitable. They did not care. These were selfish people. But here's Lot. Guests arrive to the city, and Lot says, "Come to my house." This, again, may be unique in this city. It is not normal, probably, in this city to invite guests or even care about guests. These angels are kind of walking into kind of the bad part of town. And Lot, who's the New Testament says was tormented in his righteous soul, may still be trying to live that, you know, the hospitable life. "No," they answered, "we will spend the night in the square. We will sleep in the street tonight." Again, they didn't want anything to do with Lot, apparently. But he insisted so strongly, because he knows the danger in the street, that they did go with him and entered his house. And this, again, would be a big deal to enter a house because it shows some form of fellowship. "He prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast." Now, they just got done eating lunch at Abraham's. But now they're down at Lot's. "And they ate. Before they had gone to bed," now here again, the craziness of this culture. Again, this kind of a culture that is self-centered, concerned about themselves, they do, and keep this in mind, you just watch. They do not move in an organized fashion as far as following laws and rules and what's different. They do not move in a democratic fashion. There is no way for this kind of a culture to move democratically. They don't. They move as a mob. They threaten, they intimidate, and they move as a mob. And it's not organized, and it's not fair. It's mob control. And as our culture goes one way or the other way, you can tell which way we're going. If we go more towards the way of laws and rules and try to be fair and try to build some kind of democratic, what we talk about being democratic, that's one. But if it moves more towards the mob, "We're here, we're going to do it our way, you've got to follow us, you've got to do it our way," you know which way we're sliding. We're sliding down towards that selfish, "We're number one, you've got to do what we want because that's what we want. We're not concerned about you, we're here to oppress you and use you to get what we want." And the last man, the strongest man's the last man standing. So if you're going to play that game and you're going to be all like Christian-like, you're just going to get mowed over because you're going to go right along and they're just going to play out till you're done. And then you say, "Well, Jesus had turned the other cheek." True. Except he didn't. Did you know that? Right? When Jesus, he turned the other cheek, and then when they slapped him, what did he do? He challenged them. He says, "Why'd you slap me?" He didn't say, "Well, I'm a Christian. You just hit me again." He goes, "I'm on trial here, and there's been no verdict, and you just slapped me like I'm guilty." He's at the high priest's house. The high priest had him slapped. He goes, "Why'd you slap me? I haven't been accused of being guilty." So just keep that in mind. Turn the other cheek doesn't just mean walk down. Jesus challenged the high priest, and the high priest struck him. If Jesus meant every time they slap you, you just let them hit you again, then Jesus wasn't very Christ-like when he challenged the high priest. "Why'd you hit me? You haven't even had a trial yet, and you're already treating me like I'm guilty." Just interesting stuff right there. You don't have to accept that. You can challenge that because that's unique. Verse 4, "Before they had gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old." That's a sad verse. Young and old, indicating one generation had taught the other generation this behavior. They're all there. And again, the very fact the young are there is another indication this is hopeless. The only thing to do with this is smoke it. They surrounded the house. There's your mob. They called a lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them." Now, every time I read that, it's like, I can't believe that verse is in the Bible. I mean, but that's just how blatant it is, right? Bring them out so we can have sex with them. Again, it's they're visitors, they're guests, but it's like, hey, it's something new. Bring them out so we can have sex with them. Now, the next line is another one of the most shocking verses. If that's not going to shock you, the father, Lot, his response to this is like mind-boggling. And what takes place right here, this is, again, the situation. When I've tried to teach my kids this, and we've talked about it. When you make a bad decision, you eliminate all these other options. Yeah, but I could have gone there and done that. Not anymore. You've done this. This door is closed. But, no, sometimes you can't. Can you think of something in your life where you make a decision, you no longer can go that way? You understand what I'm saying? Can you think of a situation? That option is done forever. You missed it. Okay, well, don't make a bad decision again. Okay, well, make another one or another one, and now you've closed these options and these options. I mean, you're working yourself into a corner, and you're eventually going to get to a place where you've got to make a decision. I want to do the righteous thing here. That's so noble. I just want to do the righteous thing. What, for the first time in your life, you want to do something righteous. If you say no to righteousness here, no to righteousness here, and you continue to say no and keep making bad decisions, you're going to eventually get yourself completely surrounded with no avenue towards righteousness. You say, there's always a chance. Well, then, what is he doing here? Lot says, I've got guests in my home, and I've got daughters. And these men have surrounded my house. What are my options? Well, the very fact that it's nighttime in Sodom, and you're still here, means you've made a whole series of really bad decisions. And you have nothing better to do here than this next verse. I mean, it's not like, it's just there's nothing for him to do. Well, why don't you pull out a gun? Well, yeah, you've read about the culture, haven't you? Yeah, I think they probably already got all the weapons. Okay, that's your gun control statement right there. Okay. Verse 6, Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him. And says, no, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Now, again, he's got some other daughters that are married, it appears, doesn't it? Because they've got some son-in-laws. They've never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you can do what you like with them. Now, where does that even fit in the human mentality? I mean, is he stalling for time? Has he got a backup plan? Is he just saying that to buy some time? Is he really planning on doing that? I mean, what is going on right there? Are his daughters, like, trained in martial arts, and they're just going to tear these guys up, you know? It's like some good movie or something. But don't do anything to these men, for they have come under the protection of my roof. It's like, and your daughters haven't? I mean, again, there must be something missing in this verse. Not that the Bible's wrong, but there must be some kind of information or culture or something. I think one of the things you can say is hospitality was a very valuable, very honorable thing, to be hospitable. And to have these guests violated in your hospitable invitation would be a great mar on your reputation. Again, it doesn't make sense to my mind. Yes, sir. I am. I mean, that's a possibility. But if they were angels, what would you have done? Hey, boys, go on out. They're on their way. Here they come. Right, but okay. And that's more input. But anyway, here we go. Verse 9. they replied, "Get out of our way." They replied, this is the mob. And they says, "This fellow came here as an alien." Again, he's from Ur, along with Abraham. And now he wants to play the judge, which kind of gives the impression maybe he is in a leadership position. And he's out there in the city gates because he's a leader or a judge. And now he's making a judgment here on them, saying, "No, you're not going to do this." He wants to be the judge. "We'll treat you worse than them." They kept bringing pressure on Lot and moved forward to break down the door. Again, there's your that's the culture. This would probably not be a rare, unnormal thing or unusual thing. Verse 10, "But the men inside reached out and pulled Lot back into the house." So just get some drama here. Lot's still outside and the men are crushing in. The angels reach out, grab Lot, pull him in. They reached outside, pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door. Then they struck the men who were at the door of the house, young and old, with blindness, so they could not find the door. In other words, they're buying some time. It's like, okay, now the angels are going to fly into action and do what they came. They came to observe, which is also another interesting thing. The Lord was with them that afternoon, but he stayed and talked to Abraham. The angels are down here just investigating. They have come, like he said, to go down and see if the outcry against Sodom is as bad as we have heard. And is that not a strange verse? I mean, what? God says, "I've been getting some very negative emails about Sodom. I'm going to go down and check it out myself." Sends two angels down. I mean, does God have to send angels to check stuff? I mean, can't you just know that it's bad? I mean, yeah, I'm being facetious here, but it's like the angels have to actually be there and see it. So they're there, and they're seeing how bad it is, and they're about ready to bring the final decision here. They pulled Lot in. They struck the men with blindness. Verse 12, "The two men said to Lot, 'Do you have anyone else here, anyone else in your family that belongs to you? Sons-in-law, sons or daughters, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you. Get them out of here because we are going to destroy this place.'" Now, again, that's interesting. The angels are going to destroy it, but if you follow the geography and you read the story in the Bible, it appears to be a natural. It says fire out of heaven came. Okay, I just could have sent it straight out of heaven. But if you read about the earthquake and the blowing up the petroleum, it was all natural. Once again, the angels are doing it, but they're using either heavenly tools or they're using natural tools to cause this thing to take place. Because we are going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against this people is so great that he has sent us to destroy it. So now it seems like they came for the purpose of destroying it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who were pledged to marry his daughters. Again, does that mean the two daughters had sons-in-laws that were there in some kind of a contract, or are there two other ones out there? A sons-in-law would be like Joseph and Mary. Remember how they were married or engaged, but they really weren't living together yet. So they've been, you know, the negotiation, the marriage contract had been arranged. Who were pledged to marry his daughters. He says, "Hurry and get out of this place because the Lord is about to destroy the city." But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. I mean, that would make sense. Can you imagine our culture laughing at something like that? The Lord is going to destroy the city. We've got to leave now. And then it's on, you know, I mean, that's your typical talk show material, you know. "With the coming of dawn, the angels urge Lot, saying, 'Hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished.'" So, I mean, again, what are you doing? I mean, the city's going to be burnt. Are you packing? Are you still talking to your brother-in-laws? Are you stalling? What's going on? They're urging him, "Come on, let's go." I mean, you're going to see the angels are basically going to drag Lot out of the city. Isn't that interesting? I mean, just think about his mind. I mean, they're saying, "We're angels. They just struck these guys blind. They know we're here, sent by the Lord to destroy the city. Let's go." And why are you still standing there? Why are you still waiting? Verse 16, "When he hesitated," he's still hesitating, "the men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and of his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them." You've got to think Abraham had something to do with that mercy. But they drug them out of the city. Now, you talk about the glorious rapture of the church, wherever you want to place it, here, there, mid, trib, post, wherever. It's like how many Christians, if everybody goes, and I think if you're a believer, you go in the rapture, or, you know, how many Christians are going to be like, "No, not yet," you know? And it depends on what I'm doing, too, you know? So I said that to be funny. I mean, if we're in the middle of a big game and it's the final minutes and we're about to win, it's like, not now, you know, but it's still going to be better. But nonetheless, I was trying to be funny. But he had the men, they're dragging him out of the city. The place is going to get destroyed, and he doesn't want to go, nor does his wife or his daughters. Can you just imagine, you know, just imagine you got teenage daughters. It's like, what, Dad? No, not again. No, we're not going to go. Not all teenage girls are like that. Verse 17, as soon as they had brought them out, one of them says, flee for your life. They got them out of the city and says, flee for your lives. Don't look back and don't stop anywhere in the plain. Now, again, if we come up here with some kind of a map here, if we draw the Dead Sea here, Jordan's up here, and this is the plain that is now underwater, and they're living, you know, in right in here. Sodom would be right in this case, with the archaeological evidence would be right about in this area, and there's other cities right along here. Don't dilly-dally. Don't go in the plain. Get to the mountains. Go this way, because this is where it's all going to come down. Flee for your lives. Don't look back, and don't stop anywhere in the plain. Don't stop here. Flee to the mountains, or you will be swept away. Verse 18, but Lot said to them, no, my lords, please, please. Your servant has found favor in your eyes, and you've shown great kindness to me by sparing my life, but I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me, and I'll die. I mean, I'm from Sodom. I don't work out. We're just about eating food, having party. I mean, I haven't walked that far. I'll never make it. But I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me, and I'll die. Look, here is a town near enough to run to, and it is small. Let me flee to it. It is very small, isn't it? Then my life will be spared, and I won't have a heart attack trying to run from this disaster. So, I mean, can you imagine negotiating with an angel like that? And so they said, they're going to end up saying, okay, we're going to spare sector number 23. We're going to spare the city over here. They're probably going to plan to take it. He said to them, very well, I will grant this request too. I will not overthrow the town you speak of. So he spared that town because he was too lazy to run to the mountains. I guess you call that intercession? I don't know. But flee there quickly, because I cannot do anything until you reach it. That is why the town was called Zoar, which means small. By the time Lot reached Zoar, the sun had risen over the land. Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah, from the Lord out of the heavens. Again, and you do what you want to with that. That could have just been a supernatural event. God just smote them from heaven. Or it could have been a natural, the earthquake, the storm accumulation, the lightning bolt that blew up all the petroleum that's in the area. And then it rained down like brimstone, you know, whatever you want. I believe it happened just like this. The mechanism, we're still putting the piece together. You do know, like when the Red Sea parted, what part of the Red Sea? The Bible even says what part of the Red Sea. What part of the Red Sea? The east wind, part of the Red Sea. Then east wind blew all night, and pretty soon the Red Sea's part, like the Red Sea part, and they went across. So again, natural doesn't mean it's not a miracle. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, including all those living in the cities, and also the vegetation in the land. Notice the vegetation is mentioned again. But Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Now, what does this look back mean? I mean, does this mean as they're running, she like peeks back? But that's not the case. She couldn't peek back as they're running because the fire didn't come down until they got to Zoar. They're safe in the city. I mean, then what, she looked over the city wall or something? I mean, who's not going to look over the city wall to see the disaster? Abram's going to get up the next morning and look down there and see the smoldering remains. So again, I don't know if that, does that mean she just peeked over her shoulder and she got turned into a pillar of salt for peeking back? Or does it mean she looked back as they're going, she got there, it's like, this is crazy, I'm going back. She looked back, and she went back. And now again, be careful, don't let me make stuff up here. But there are there literal pillars of salt in this area where there just were things. And anybody that would have been running in the streets when that stuff came down, what would they have been? A pillar of brimstone and all the minerals that would have covered them up. When it says salt, that doesn't mean white crystal salt off your table. That's the mineral. This is called the Dead Sea because of the salt content. And the salt content is all of the minerals that have flown in here, and they stay. And so this right here that would have been just covered up with the mineral deposit that came down with the explosion. And so at that time, when it says she turned to a pillar of salt, that maybe doesn't mean there she is, the pillar of salt, Lot's wife. It may mean she joined all the others as pillars of salt. She became one of the pillars of salt, and because she was there when it rained down. Okay, and that ends up, and she became a pillar of salt. Verse 27, early the next morning, Abram got up and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He looked down towards Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, he's over in this area here. And so if he looked down, and again, this is a plain. This goes down to this. So, I mean, you can see right, even when you're over here, you can see the mountains of Moab over here. You see, I mean, you're here, you can see the mountains because it's a lake, it's a sea. So for Abraham to be here and look down, that's very understandable. He can see this whole mess right here. What used to be a plain, yesterday it was a vegetated plain where there's vegetables growing and it's green. Early the next morning, Abraham looked up and returned to the place where he and the Lord had stood. He looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, toward all the land of the plain, and saw dense smoke rising from the land like smoke from a furnace. So when God destroyed the cities of the plain, he remembered Abraham, and he brought Lot out of the catastrophe and overthrew the cities where Lot had lived. And again, you can see right there, Lot was spared now very clearly because of Abraham, God's covenant with Abraham. That's Lot's one of Abraham's people, and God even tells Lot, or the angels tell Lot, do you have any other people here? Is there anybody else? We'll get them out too. So Abraham to Lot. So there's that family connection. Verse 30, what, we got time. Verse 30, another interesting set of verses here. And again, before we read this, we got to establish again the importance of family, the importance of genealogy, the importance of having a woman having a child. Remember how Sarah wanted a child? She was willing to bring Hagar in so Hagar could produce a child. And so this situation right here that we're going to be reading about here with Lot and his daughters, again, it sounds very crash, very, you know, yeah, are you raising your hand? Not that I know of, and again, I'm not sure if we know where Zoar's at. I mean, it may be marked, and it may be speculated or something. But again, the very fact that they say it's very small probably doesn't help. It's probably more of like a village than a walled city. And I'm just speaking off the top of my head. I don't know of anything about Zoar or if they can identify. They're really, I mean, again, they've got ideas here. Some say it's buried underneath here. This month they're talking about it up here. So again, this is really open as far as there's nothing concrete. Listen, these cities were destroyed by something coming down from above, it looks like. Is that Sodom and Gomorrah? They haven't found a little sign that says Sodom. This up here also has the same kind of brimstone destruction. There's a burn layer that matches this down up in here. And that's why they're saying this is Sodom, because it's right across from Ai and Bethel. So that matches. So, I mean, it's not a matter of do you think it really happened. I think it really happened. We're not sure exactly where it was. And Zoar, I think, would probably fall into that category too. But I don't know for sure. Yes. Right. There you have. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so don't look back and don't stop anywhere on the plane. Yeah. And I guess, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you want to go with just that, but I can't imagine. I think the looking back has to be. I read it. Does anybody remember this terrible book from the 70s called The Chariots of the Gods? Come on, someone's got to remember Chariots of the Gods. You remember the movie The Chariots of the Gods? This was all where they're trying to take science fiction and science and Bible and bring it all together. And all of these events, and I read it as probably, I don't know if I was 14 years old or something, I don't remember, maybe 16, it doesn't matter. But it's like, I was right at that age of really looking for truth, you know, and have the Bible explained. It was one of my first commentaries. And it's like, they said right here in this, but they explained everything. Again, I'm way off subject, I apologize. But this is the goofy stuff that's in that book. When Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? It was part of a plan, and he needed more medication. They had some kind of, you know, it was UFOs were bringing him medication. He didn't feel the pain. And, I mean, that's just a ridiculous thing. And I'm reading it, like, for the first time the Bible's being explained to me for the first time. I'm like, oh, I've been in church my whole life, but finally someone's explaining all these miracles. So this is great. And in this case right here, she was running, and she looked back, and because of what was taking place here, they says something affected her eyes, crystallized and caused a chemical change in her body, and she became salt because of what she saw. When you look at a nuclear explosion, it causes some kind of, it's like, what? And I thought, wow. But anyway, that was because they said she looked directly at the nuclear explosion and it crystallized her or something. So I always think of that. My first commentary. Chariots of the Gods. Anybody remember Chariots of the Gods? I had one back there, two here. And you remember the Chariots of the Gods? Did you like it? Was it good? Yeah, I never saw the movie. I just read the book. Okay. Anyway, here we go. Lot and his daughters. Another story. Verse 30. Lot and his two daughters left Zoar. Now again, why did they leave Zoar? And they're going to go live in the mountains. I mean, it must have been bad. Think about it. I mean, why are you leaving? And settled in the mountains, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar. Because he's an alien? I mean, because it's so wicked? Remember, what was Zoar on the destruction list? Yes. And it was spared because Lot wanted it spared. And he gets there, it's so bad he can't live there. So he escapes Zoar and probably wishes he would have had the thing, but he ends up in the mountains anyhow. I mean, just understand, that's interesting. God spared the wickedness, but it was so wicked he couldn't even live there. That's why God was destroying it. Okay, so they're living there because they're completely cut off from civilization. Then you ask questions, why does he come back to Abram? Why does he just stay up here? Is he too old to move? What's going on? Well, here we go. He and his two daughters lived in a cave. And again, they didn't start in a cave. He originally came out of Ur of the Chaldeans, a very wealthy city. It had indoor sewers, or it had indoor plumbing at this time. It had a library. So that whole concept of caveman, you know, we came out of caves and we're becoming, you know, we got computers now. It's like, no, we started in a garden and we fell into caves just like Lot. Lot is now a caveman. But he was originally a very civilized man from Ur of the Chaldeans, so wealthy over here that him and Abram had a split company because they had so many possessions. And now he is alone in a cave. Where do cavemen come from? They don't come out of the dirt. They come because of sin and rebellion, and they end up in a cave. So are there cavemen in human history? Right, but that wasn't God's intention to live in a cave. He and his two daughters lived in a cave. One day, the older daughter said to the younger, and again, this sounds ridiculous to our culture, but it makes complete sense in their culture. They need a family. They are nothing without children. They have no one to take care of in the future. They have that's their life, is children, to have a heritage. Our father is old, and there is no man around here to lie with us, as is the custom all over the earth. Let's get our father, in other words, custom would mean marriage, family. There's no, we're just living here in a cave. Let's get our father to drink wine and then lie with him and preserve our family line through our father. That night, they got their, again, this is a ridiculous story, but they have just like a, we're talking about Judah and Tamar. Remember how Tamar went to get the seed from Judah and tricked him, you know, her father-in-law, so that she could have a child? It's like, what was she doing? She was trying to get the seed that he wouldn't give her through the son that was lawfully hers. And so it's like, what was wrong with that girl? Nothing. She knows that I belong to this family and I've been cut out, and that's my survival. I need to have that seed to produce a child. And same thing here. They need the seed to produce a child. That night they got their father to drink wine, and the older daughter went in and lay with him. He was not aware of it, and when she lay down or when she got up. The next day the older daughter says to the younger, last night I lay with my father. Let's get him to drink wine again tonight, and you go in and lie with him so that we can preserve our family line through our father. See, that's their motive. I mean, it's a pure motive, but once again, I mean, this is God's plan that they produce and have families and multiply, but it's like, they've made so many bad decisions, they have no righteous way of going about doing God's plan. And so they have to become unrighteous and immoral and ungodly to try to even stay on track. Now, again, I would hope there's some other alternative. But again, when you make so many bad decisions, you end up like this. So they got their father to drink wine that night also, and the younger daughter went and lay with him. Again, he was not aware of it when she lay down or when she got up. So both of Lot's daughters became pregnant by their father. The older daughter had a son, and she named him Moab. And you don't want to forget that. That's the Moabites. He is the father of the Moabites of today. Again, that's interesting, of today, because it helps you understand when this is all being edited. Again, this is information probably being edited by Moses. And he is going to encounter the Moabites, and that's when he's going to encounter Balak, the king of the Moabites, and they're going to bring down the prophet Balaam to curse the Israelites. So again, when Moses, if he's the one editing this, he points it out, it's like, yeah, he's about ready to deal with the Moabites. He is the father of the Moabites of today. The younger daughter also had a son, and she named him Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the Ammonites, and the Ammonites live just north of the Moabites, especially when we're talking about Moses coming up over on this side. This was the Moabites here. Interesting, same location. And the Ammonites over here. And then, of course, Esau's family down here, the Edomites. So this is Lot's family here. This is Esau's family here. And this is Isaac's family going to be over here. And, of course, you know who comes from the Moabites, you know, in Jesus' line? Ruth. Ruth is a Moabite. So as the whole story comes all down, David, if Ruth is his grandmother, right? Great-grandmother? Either grandmother or great-grandmother. That means David is like, you know, a fourth or an eighth Moabite. Interesting, right? And then if Solomon is the son of who? David and Bathsheba, who's most likely a Hittite, because Uriah the Hittite, unless he married an Israelite. That means Solomon's half Hittite, not even half Israeli, because he's still like an eighth or a 16th Moabite. Solomon's like, you know, less than half Israelite, if you want to look at that. That's kind of interesting when you break it down like that, maybe. Okay, well, let's go on with our story. Moabites today, the younger daughter also had a son named Ben-Ammi. He is the father of the Ammonites of today. Verse 20, or chapter 20. Now, Abraham. Okay, good. Back to Abraham. Now Abraham moved on from there into the region of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur. Now, again, the Negev would be, if we get this map going right here, and we're going to wrap this up here and pick this up next week. I should ask if there's any questions here before we're done. We're kind of on some touchy issues here this evening. Here's the Dead Sea. It's a big Dead Sea. This is the Negev down here. Kadesh is right about here. I made this way too big, right here. And Shur is down towards Egypt. So Abraham is down in this area right here. And life continues. For a while, he stayed in Gera. That's a Philistine city. That's over here by the coast. And there Abram said to his wife, Sarah, Abram said of his wife, Sarah, she is my sister. Then Abimelech, king of Gera, sent for Sarah and took her. Oh, I guess we're not clear. I thought maybe we'd get some good information there, but it's still going downhill. So it's like, so now Sarah's now in the harem of the Philistine king. And again, we ask about this, are these Philistines? Because we, and this is something I'm kind of dealing with right now, kind of trying to play. We want to call them Philistines, but these people are going to be driven out by people from the Isle of Crete coming over. And it records it several times in the Bible. Even Moses records it and other prophets record it. So the Philistines aren't really there. They're still Canaanites. So they're not Philistines as the Greeks that are going to come in. The Philistines are Greeks that drive these people out. So it's just interesting how that all plays out. There may be some early arrivals, but that's some other things we don't have time to get into that right now. But anyway, are there any questions or comments or clarifications, please? Chapter 18. Oh, okay, yep. Oh, the outcry. Okay, it's the outcry against Sodom. Right. Yep. Yeah, what's yours say? How's it? Okay. Okay. Yeah, the outcry, it's against. Yeah, I'm not sure. What does anybody else have? I'm using the NIV, and the NIV will kind of clarify those things. And I don't know off the top of my head what the cry is, just a cry of Sodom. And you're using a Japanese Bible, correct? So that right there is not an NIV Bible, New American Standard. That's a direct translation into Japanese from the Greek or the Hebrew text, the Masoretic text. And so what you've got there, that may be, you may want to look at what your translation say, where it says in chapter 18, verse 20, mine says, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, I'm not sure. It would appear because of that Bible, they either made a mistake and didn't translate a word, or it's not in the Hebrew, and it just says the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah. Which now you've got to decide, cry, are they crying out for help, like Sinai was thinking? Or who's crying? You know? Well, it may be here. I'm guessing that they're going to say, well, it's an outcry against them. And that's what does anybody else have anything in their Bibles? Right. So read verse 20. Just read verse 20 for me. Okay. So that gives me the impression that there's no against. It just says the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so that's why so the King James and the Japanese are going right from the Masoretic text and just translating it word for word. Okay. Right. Or the people living in there. It may be the people of Sodom. Again, we talked about the oppressing the poor and needy. It may be the outcry of the poor and needy. It may be Sodom crying out for help, but it's not the wealthy and the rich. It's the oppressed that are in Sodom. Any other thoughts or comments? Hey, I appreciate you being here. Thank you for taking time. I hope that was helpful at some level. Kind of an ugly story, but there it happened. I'm going to pray, and then we are finished. Thank you very much for being here. Father, we do thank you again for the opportunity to be here. We thank you for watching over us. We do ask that we may again use these things, that we would consider your truth, that we would make righteous decisions, that we'd be encouraged by your word, by each other, and by your spirit to walk in righteousness, so we may again walk in the light and be in the light and have your word shine as a light on our path and not be in a corner where we have no right or wrong. We don't know what to do. Father, we do ask you to continue to give us options, but also, Father, please, for our country, we pray and ask for revival, that we would have a chance to make good decisions, that we again may see the light of your love in our country and in our land. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Hey, thank you very much.